They become publishers, they become journalists, they become their own advertising agency.
She means the White House, which is getting better and better at working around the Washington Press Corps. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A case before the Supreme Court will decide if, when you're arrested, the police can take your DNA.
Fingerprints are typically used to identify somebody. DNA is typically used to solve cold cases, to solve a case wholly different from that for which the person was arrested.
Also, Brooke sat down with Asif Mandvi to talk about, among many other things, his role as a correspondent on a show famous for its fake news.
So, as a fake journalist doing fake news, do you feel any sense of journalistic responsibility?
None.
And there's lots more coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Aren't you tired of hearing that Congress is broken? I mean, what's Obama doing for our crumbling political infrastructure? That question was posed to the president at Friday's White House press briefing.
Harry Shapiro.
Thank you, Mr. President. You said a few minutes ago, and you've said repeatedly, that the country has to stop careening from crisis to crisis. So with a few crises behind us and a few more crises ahead of us, taking a step back from this specific debate over the sequester, how, as the leader of this country, do you plan to stop the country from careening from crisis to crisis?
Well, a couple of things. Number one,
not a bad question exactly, but so broad, so just kind of zeitgeisty, the reporter surely knew it wouldn't yield any real information. Then again, as Bob observes in this report, White House press briefings rarely ever do.
Marine One circles in the winter rain and alights on the White House South Lawn, returning from a staged event at a Virginia shipyard to gin up support for the administration's revenue proposals. President Obama decopters and strides purposefully across the soggy grass toward the Oval Office. Witnessing this extremely high-level walking are some 50 observers huddled under umbrellas and making small talk. Cameras click and whir in perfunctory unison. The return leg from Newport News to Washington No News has been duly recorded. Ladies and gentlemen, your White House press corps in action.
The White House is where news goes to die. Everything's canned. These perfectly prepared statements.
It's a prestigious job, Zoe.
It used to be when I was in ninth grade. Now it's a graveyard. The only halfway interesting thing they do is throw a big dinner party once a year where they pat themselves on the back and rub shoulders with movie stars. Who needs that?
That's a particularly resonant bit of dialogue from the Netflix series House of Cards, an inside-the-beltway melodrama in which the conflict tends to be a bit more compelling than the real-life version. On TV, there's lots of skullduggery and drinking and illicit sex. In the White House briefing room, it's mainly talking points.
In anticipation of the meeting Friday, the president did invite four leaders.
In the past week, the press corps' very relevance has been questioned in Slate and also in Politico, which called Obama a puppet master. Guess who are the puppets? That's what I asked CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett, although I chose the slightly less pejorative term, stenographer.
The president has a message. He's the leader of the free world, and his message deserves to be communicated. That is a prerogative of the presidency. Conveying that accurately is not stenography, and I don't consider that beneath me.
The nagging question this week, though, was what has displaced him? Once upon a time, these ink-stained barracudas, whether sardined into their cramped West Wing annex or on the road with the president, represented the only way to efficiently reach the electorate. Those dynamics, every now and then, did result in some drama, such as the 1974 confrontation between CBS's Dan Rather and President Richard Nixon.
Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
Tens of millions of people tuned into what were then all three networks gasped at Rather's impertinence. But today's reporters and photographers have been marginalized by a gazillion other channels. Twitter, MySpace, Facebook, the White House's ongoing blog, the Ask Me Anything forum on Reddit, and on TV, not much evening news, but plenty of Live at 5, David Letterman, and The View. The White House is now itself a kind of media house. Ann Compton of ABC News.
They become publishers. They become journalists. They become their own advertising agency.
Never mind one-on-ones with the president, says Compton, who's covering her seventh presidential administration. Most of the time, reporters can't even get access enough to shout out questions at a grip-and-grin session.
We don't cover Oval Office photo ops. We don't cover many of the meetings he has when he meets with people on immigration or gun violence or the fiscal cliff, the meetings with Congress. It's been 6 months since I've even been in the Oval Office on my turn to be the pool member in there. To shut the media out to the extent this administration has, I think, is a disgrace.
And when administration officials do make themselves available, the information is almost always on background, which means nobody's name gets attached to the subsequent story and no official is held accountable. For Fox News correspondent Ed Henry, the final straw came with an event entirely closed to the press. Okay, it wasn't a summit or a bill signing. Okay, it was a golf game between Obama and Tiger Woods. Nonetheless, in his capacity as president of the White House Correspondents Association, Henry excoriated the administration for Operation Zero Dark 18 Holes, a complaint that White House Deputy Press Secretary Joshua Earnest shrugged off.
Sometimes the president's commitment to engaging with the American public means that there are some members of the White House press corps who get a little frustrated that they're not getting as many interviews as they would like. But at the end of the day, the president's responsibility is not to the members of the White House press corps. It's actually to the American public. That's not the only way that we can fulfill our responsibilities. In order to fulfill his responsibility, to communicate his priorities, the president needs to avail himself of all the opportunity to do that. And that's something that we've done with a lot of success here.
For instance, News Anchor Day. While the captive Washington press corps cooled its heels approximately 20 feet away recently, the president sat down with anchors from eight local stations from around the country, among them Kevin Ogle of KFOR Oklahoma City, who didn't necessarily go for the jugular.
You know, here I am, some local yokel from Oklahoma City, getting to go up and interview the president, and we had limited time, and so there's not a lot of opportunity to ask follow-up questions, you know, or to take him to task on things.
In other words, no Nixon versus Rather moments?
No, it wasn't like that at all.
Instead, Ogle passed along viewer questions, including one from basketball star Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
This comes from KD. Putting your loyalty to the Bulls aside, what are your thoughts on Oklahoma City's Thunder basketball team? You know who KD is?
I do. I've had a chance to play with him. He's a great guy. You know, his mother and his grandmother still live in this area.
In contrast, Susan Peters of KAKE Cake Wichita was fairly aggressive in questioning Obama's plan to cut tax exemptions for Kansas's big corporate aircraft industry. That's right after she handed the president a scrapbook she made of his mom's Kansas heritage. I wondered if she thought she and her local colleagues had been fully respected. Did you get the sense that they looked at you, all eight of you, like eight Ron Burgundies?
I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal.
Bob, you put it very well. Now, I don't know if they looked at us like Ron Burgundies, but I do think the administration, think they can get their message out better through local anchors than through the White House press corps. I do definitely think that.
But she jumped at the opportunity anyway. Who wouldn't?
To be honest with you, it was thrilling. It was thrilling being in the White House interviewing the President of the United States. But the national media, they not only know the questions to ask, but they have the perspective behind the questions that local reporters and local anchors can't have. I would say, you go, White House Press Corps. You are crucial to us. And any attempt to diminish their role, I feel, is completely wrong.
Before I left the briefing room one day this week, I ran into E.J. Dionne, inveterate political analyst for The Washington Post, PBS, and NPR. I asked him if this administration has perfected the end around.
Well, I think all presidents try to get around the press corps, and now there are more opportunities to do it. But there is still a very large share of the population that's going to get its news mediated, no matter how much we talk about the irrelevance of traditional journalism. It's still a big enough audience that they have to worry about it.
Yep, are we ready?
And with that, Dionne went into a briefing about the sequestration showdown for a handful of the press corps. On background, of course. So, no, the lights in the White House briefing room won't be switched off anytime soon. The place still plays an important role.
We think it's as many as 40,000 people will lose jobs.
But to understand how things have changed, one merely needs to look up at the podium. As Jay Carney reads scripted answers to a reporter's question, just behind him, next to the iconic White House seal, hangs a giant flat-screen TV scrolling all the up-to-the-minute headlines. The source? The White House blog.
So, Bob, I noticed you made mention of Fox News' Ed Henry filing a complaint about poor access. Why didn't you put his voice in the piece?
I couldn't do that. We repeatedly sought comment from the president of the White House Correspondents Association on the subject of reporters having access to the president, but President Henry declined to make himself available.
Oh. And now, a request to you listeners. This week, the Copyright Alert System, also known as the Six Strikes Program, went into effect. It's the latest effort by the movie and music industries, in cooperation with internet service providers, to curb piracy. Now, no one who illegally downloads is going to get kicked off the internet, but they will receive a series of warnings, six to be exact, that will range from directing offenders to places where they can get legal access to copyrighted material to temporarily slowing down their internet speed. What we want to know is, how is this going to work in practice? On the off chance that one of you gets a warning, or several, would you send them to us? You know, screenshots or even videos of punitively slowed internet? Send them to onthemedia@wnyc.org, subject line, six strikes. Basketball legend turned broadcaster Walt Clyde Frazier has turned courtside commentary into pure poetry.
Erratic, dramatic, charismatic, acrobatic.
His flashy rhymes and dazzling suits express one side of the man called Clyde, but obscure the other, the entrepreneur, gardener, yoga aficionado. Join me on March 8th at New York Public Radio's Jerome L. Green Space for a chat with Walt Frazier about his life in basketball and broadcasting and those suits. For tickets, go to onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We just heard Bob assess the relevance of the White House press corps. And certainly presidents have long sought ways to communicate outside the media filter. For instance, the Obama administration launched its We the People online petition site in 2011. Once a petition garners 100,000 names, that number keeps rising, it's guaranteed a response from the White House. You might recall that petition to build a Death Star, which earned the wry reply, quote, "The administration does not support blowing up planets." It doesn't matter what a petition calls for, as long as, theoretically, it's something the government can do something about. Not long ago, radio host Alex Jones told listeners to petition for CNN's Piers Morgan to be deported for his views on guns.
He needs to be on the first airplane shackled out of this country because he's here trying to take our Second Amendment.
The White House sent everyone who'd signed that and similar gun-related petitions a video response from the president.
Now, like the majority of Americans, I believe that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to bear arms. We've got a strong tradition of gun ownership that's been handed down from generation to generation.
Time magazine White House correspondent Michael Shearer says the petitions provide the White House with a uniquely effective way to communicate.
Well, if you're sitting in the White House these days, you have a problem. 30 years ago, something like 50 million people would tune into the nightly news, and so you could just go to the three networks. Right now, the media is so splintered. People are getting their news from niche outlets, and a lot of them are the president's opponents. Talk radio listeners are the biggest category, and the president really has no way of communicating directly with them. So when this idea of creating an online petition system inside the White House came up, that was the real selling point for the senior staff. The public would self-organize into groups around the issues they cared about, and then the White House would be able to basically build email lists and communicate directly their message about those issues with those people.
What was the impact of this message that Obama directed to those who signed Alex Jones' petition?
Yeah, the Alex Jones example is really a delightful one. Alex Jones is a very entertaining talk radio host who talks about the coming globalist tyranny. And he, late last year, decided that the White House petition system was a great way for him to drum up publicity for his show. And so on a number of issues, including deporting Piers Morgan, the CNN host, was encouraging his rather large audience to go to the White House website. You know, other reporters were seeing hundreds of thousands of people signing on to these petitions. And so he thought this was a wonderful thing. At the White House, they were equally happy that a talk radio host was driving so much of his audience base directly into their hands. And it gave them the opportunity that they had actually always hoped they would have, a way of directly communicating what they think is the biggest fallacy of the gun debate, that Obama wants to take your guns away. You know, the White House maintains, and the president's proposals are pretty clear, that they don't want to take any guns that anybody has. And the traffic on that video was actually very high. The 400,000 people who were clicking on that video were coming to the video because most of them had expressed concern about guns and what the White House was doing. So the audience had self-selected and delivered itself up to the White House.
How do we know that this had any impact, this Obama video?
Well, after the video was sent out, the White House followed up by asking people on that email list to basically fill out a questionnaire about what they thought. It wasn't a scientific poll because people weren't required to respond. But of those people who responded, and these are people, remember, who had come into this process because they were angry at the White House. One in four, I think, said they learned something new. And majorities, in some cases, said, you know, they were pretty happy with this process.
So it was used in this way to communicate with the president's opponents. It's also used to deepen the relationship with the president's allies.
So there are a lot of friendly petitions as well. For instance, last year there was a petition for the president to do something about comprehensive immigration reform. After they got the petition, the White House took the list of emails they had and they sent people an invite to join a conference call with some policy folks at the White House. It was a way for the White House to show real engagement. You know, another interesting example is a couple of years ago, there was a fight over online piracy and Hollywood was pushing for new rules that would protect their content. Silicon Valley types, people who work on the internet, were upset about this bill. They petitioned the White House. As a result of that petition, the White House made public its position on this bill, and the White House was pretty skeptical of the Hollywood effort. And by making public its position, the White House doesn't always take a position on every bill, it helped lead to the defeat of the bill in the Senate. So there was actually a causal relationship between the petition and the petitioner's wishes being fulfilled.
You've noted that petitions have a long political history, that the Declaration of Independence includes the line, "Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury." So how long have petitions been around?
They've basically been around as long as human civilization has been around. Back in Mesopotamia, they were known as letter prayers, and they were written on clay tablets. In Egypt, they were written on papyrus. Roman law was actually made up in large part of responses to petitions. For most of the history, petitions were basically prayers to a higher authority. They were ways for monarchs to govern. You know, people would come to them and say they're upset about the taxes on their goats or whatever the issue was, and the monarch could appear responsive and basically control his kingdom. That changed when the printing press was developed. Suddenly, petitions became not just ways of praying for relief, but also for protesting and pushing. The internet is sort of taking this petition system to the next step, because you also have an ability to create two-way communication much more effectively than you did with just the printing press. And that's really what the White House is embracing here. They're not just getting a list of names of people who want a change on whatever the policy is. They're able to talk back directly to those people. And in some cases, those people are then again able to talk back to the White House. And so you have a dialogue on a real mass scale.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
Michael Shear is Time Magazine's White House correspondent.
Consider this. There you are, minding your own business, when you get arrested, accused of some crime, and, well, you know how it goes. You get read your Miranda rights, and you're taken to the police station, where they ask you a lot of questions, take your fingerprints to verify your identity, and then they swab your cheek and collect a sample of your DNA. That last part, the DNA swab part, is a relatively new twist. Though it's now a common practice in about half the states and on the federal level, it doesn't require anything more than your arrest. Well, that could soon change. On Tuesday of this week, the Supreme Court heard arguments about whether this practice is constitutional and what kind of privacy incursion routinely taking DNA might represent. Adam Liptak writes about the High Court for the New York Times. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, Bob.
Let's start with the case that was the center of discussion Tuesday. It concerned one Alonzo J. King.
Alonzo King is arrested for assault. They swab his cheek as part of the arrest process. It pops up in a database. He later was convicted of raping a 54-year-old woman. And the question in the case was whether that evidence should be suppressed, because it may be that the Fourth Amendment says that swabbing his cheek was the sort of search that requires either a warrant or at least some level of individualized suspicion. And it's not clear you have that here merely because you're arrested for a wholly different crime.
The central question is whether DNA collection is the equivalent of fingerprinting, which police have done for many decades, or whether it's something different.
Well, that's exactly the right question, because fingerprints, although not exclusively, are typically used to identify somebody, to tell you if you've got the right guy, and maybe to tell you what that guy's been convicted of, what his rap sheet is. DNA these days is typically used not for identification purposes, but to solve cold cases, to solve a case wholly different from that for which the person was arrested. Now, the two things may be converging over time, and there was a lot of discussion at the argument saying, well, I understand today they're different, but 2 years from now, 5 years from now, we may have the ability to turn around the DNA evidence so quickly that you can use it for identification. You can use it to help a judge make a decision about whether to let somebody go on bail. So one question for the court is whether to spin this forward a couple years out or whether to deal with the facts on the ground today.
Yeah, and if you spin it more than a couple years out, it makes your head hurt, because while fingerprints don't have much more function than IDing someone's location at a crime scene, the DNA says so much more. It could tell the police, if they were interested, what diseases you have or will have. It can say something about future generations of your progeny. That's a lot of information to entrust to the cops.
Yeah, so the cops, you know, the federal government in the state of Maryland said, we don't use it for that purpose. We only look at 16 markers on the DNA, and that tells us nothing but who you are, a kind of barcode of your identification, and we're not going to look at that other stuff. You should please trust us. And I'm not sure the Supreme Court is necessarily ready to trust the government with such a trove of information about which most people probably think they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. On the other hand, we do leave DNA behind all the time. So a question that a lawyer for Mr. King had a hard time with was, okay, what if we don't swab his cheek? What if we just offer him a root beer? And when he leaves that behind, we swab that. Does he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that can that he left behind?
What was your sense of the justice's direction on this case?
It was really closely divided, and it didn't ideologically match up with some of what you might think. So when the lawyer for Maryland starts by saying, this really works great, we got 200 matches and 50 hits, and we solved all these cold cases, Justice Scalia, typically conservative, says, well, that's great. I bet all kinds of unreasonable searches would let you solve all kinds of crimes. So he seemed to be going in a pro-defendant direction. Justice Breyer, typically on the liberal side, seemed to think this was a very valuable tool and a fairly minor intrusion.
I always do this to you, and I know it's unfair, but what's going to happen?
It may well turn on the vote of Chief Justice Roberts, who said things pointing in both directions, but did something unusual as the court was agreeing to hear the case. He unilaterally stayed the decision of Maryland's highest court, which had suppressed the evidence, and said that Maryland could, in the meantime, while the court hears arguments, go on and collect this kind of information. And if I'm right that he may be the decisive vote, he sort of tipped his hand that he may be okay with this kind of DNA collection.
Adam, as always, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times.
The issue of individual privacy often comes before the high court to be scrutinized and judged. But the privacy of food producers seems to be an almost inalienable right. It wasn't always the case. Over a century ago, a novelist named Upton Sinclair went undercover in the meatpacking industry, and the resulting book, The Jungle, was so disturbing it changed how the country thought about its food. Since then, many journalists have used the same tactic to expose the hidden corners of our food supply. In 2008, an undercover investigation exposed the malpractice of a California meat processor.
An investigation by the Humane Society of the United States uncovers abuse of down dairy cows, cows too sick or too injured to stand, at a California slaughterhouse. What's more, the meat is being served to children through the National School Lunch Program.
That undercover investigation resulted in the largest meat recall in U.S. history. But in recent years, a number of states either have passed or considered laws that would effectively criminalize such reporting. Will Potter, who will describe some disturbing practices in our interview, is author of Green is the New Red. He says that these so-called ag gag bills have become the law in Utah, Iowa, Missouri, and have been appearing and reappearing in almost a dozen other states.
In New Hampshire, Nebraska, Indiana, Wyoming, and Arkansas, bills have already been introduced. And in North Carolina, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania, they should be coming any week now. The recent spate of bills that we've been watching introduced around the country zero in on the criminalization of photography and videotaping of animal enterprises. Some of them are so broad that they criminalize anyone who documents from the road or from passing by what some of these facilities look like. In addition to that, they criminalize possessing and distributing these materials.
A lot of these bills are constructed as efforts to combat terrorism, eco-terrorism or otherwise, and yet it seems to be criminalizing information.
Absolutely. The original argument was they were needed to go after underground extremists like the Animal Liberation Front, who are destroying property, stealing animals, breaking windows. That's been completely ignored at this point. These are all about targeting undercover investigators, not arsonists. So, for instance, in Indiana, one of the bills that's been introduced, in the very first few lines, it says that farmers have the right to engage in agricultural operations free from the threat of terrorism by unauthorized third parties. It then goes on to say that anyone who takes photographs or video images of what takes place on these farms will be targeted. Similarly, the supporters and sponsors of this legislation have been using that rhetoric as well. So David Hinkins, who's a state senator from Utah, he actually said that the people being targeted are trying to kill the animal industry, and he called them terrorists on the Senate floor.
You have FBI files going back as far as 2003 recommending that undercover investigators be prosecuted as terrorists. The FBI and those legislators who are also using the T word seem to make no distinction between the activists who have caused real physical damage and those in collecting information might cause economic loss when wrongdoing is exposed. Is economic loss terrorism?
When I testified against a law called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act back in 2006, lawmakers in the FBI, the Justice Department, all responded that this type of legislation would not be used against investigators or whistleblowers or protesters. It was only about people that are destroying property. What we've seen is that legislation and many of these other bills focus on economic loss. And when we start talking about the loss of profits, the most significant threat to those prophets in recent years has not been broken windows. It's been activists who are actually opening windows into how these operations work by creating video footage.
So what are some of the things that these undercover investigators have revealed in the last few years that if these laws are passed, they may never reveal again?
Around the country, these undercover investigators have revealed really horrible violence, such as in California at the Central Valley meatpacking plant, where a slaughterhouse worker stood on a cow's nostrils attempting to suffocate her. And in North Carolina, we saw workers at a butterball plant kicking and beating turkeys with rods, slamming them across the floor. We've seen workers body slamming piglets onto a concrete floor in order to kill them. In California, at Hallmark, it was exposed that the slaughterhouse facility was actually pulling what are called in the industry downer cows, which are cows that are on the ground because they've collapsed. According to the industry and the USDA, these animals are not allowed to enter the food supply. What undercover investigators showed was that these animals were entering the food supply repeatedly.
In response to these bills, you've heard from the Humane Society and the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The activist groups, by design, are biased in favor of one position. Do you think that if journalists got into this fray, they might be able to marshal more public support against these bills?
Absolutely. Many of these bills are explicit about not just targeting the people who do the investigation, but the people who distribute it, who republish it. For instance, there was an investigation a couple of years ago that at the same time the group Mercy for Animals was conducting the investigation, ABC News was following along with it, aired the same footage after they verified it, and it drew national attention to this and criminal charges. Under these bills, in North Carolina, for example, both the investigator and the journalist would be wrapped up together.
Will, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Will Potter is the author of the book, Green is the New Red, and a blog of the same name.
Coming up, a conversation with actor Asif Mandvi about life and art and being the Daily Show's senior Muslim correspondent.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Asif Mandvi is a stage and film actor, a writer and teller of stories, and senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show. Born in India, raised in the UK, transplanted as a teenager to the Floridian paradise called Tampa, his background is so layered he calls himself a turducken. He's a purveyor of fake news, an advocate of real issues, a Muslim, but not, he says, the best example of one. Nevertheless, in an industry that hasn't very many, an example he must be. This week, I sat down with Asif for a live event at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Space. I began by asking about his influences, and he told me about being inspired early on by the Fonz.
I used to watch Happy Days when I was a kid, and I thought that acting was riding around in a motorcycle and a leather jacket in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I sort of emulated these sort of American TV characters and kind of wanted to do that. But then I got into theater. I ended up going to like a children's theater after school thing. And that was really where it all began.
You were a performer at Busch Gardens in Tampa.
Yes.
And when The Daily Show sent you to Tampa in advance of
yes.
the Republican National mm-hmm. Convention, you went and visited your old boss at Busch Gardens, and we have a clip of that.
You had this ability to talk on and on and on in this Arabic gibberish kind of nonsense language.
That wasn't gibberish, Alan. That was just the way I used to talk back then.
Oh.
What else do you remember?
I remember firing you.
Well, you don't seem upset about it.
It was 25 years ago, and we moved on.
Yeah, I've moved on too, Alan, okay? I'm doing big things, you know? Played a lot of doctors.
and the occasional terrorist and deli owner.
Poor Alan. He was really excited to be on The Daily Show. And then we kind of ambushed him with this whole, like, you remember when you fired me kind of thing, which he didn't really remember. I had to remind him of, because it was a big deal in my career and in my life. Like, I was devastated. It was my first real sort of acting job, and I got fired. It was because I had taken some medication. Right?
I always use that excuse when I'm fired.
I took some cold medicine and was asleep in the break room and missed like a half a day's work, and so they fired me. But he had no recollection of that, and I had to remind him. But he was a lot of fun. He completely played along, and then I think at the end of it, he sort of might have been a little sorry that he did it. Which
he must have known, if he was a viewer of The Daily Show, that he was going to end up.
Yeah, well, I think
like
he
idiot.
Thought he was going to talk about, you know, me being a street performer at Busch Gardens, and all the Busch Gardens executives were there, you know, who are all his bosses and stuff. And then, like, I pull out, like, remember when you fired me, you ass? And so the poor guy was a little, I think he was a little thrown.
How much is ambushing a Daily Show strategy?
It's not really a strategy. I mean, there are two kinds of things that we do. We do sit-down interviews with people, and then we do a man-on-the-street stuff. And of course, with man-on-the-street stuff, there is an inherent sort of ambushing that happens where people are not expecting to be asked a question. In the interviews that we set up, there are sometimes, you know, things that people expect to be asked or they're going to talk about, and then there are, we might go off into an area where they don't expect to be asked those questions. And I guess that inherently is kind of an ambush situation. But that's kind of where you get the real stuff, the real moments. I think that we live in an age and a culture where everyone feels like they have something to say and a point of view, and they need to get it out. And sometimes we're the only people that will talk to them. and they need to find an outlet. And then there's also something Stephen Colbert said to me when I first started on The Daily Show. They sent me to have a meeting with him and ask about doing field pieces. And he said to me, one of the things he said to me was, when you put a camera in somebody's face, they get a lobotomy. So remember that.
How did you get hooked up with The Daily Show?
It was really just an audition. And initially, I said no, because, you know, I'd gone to these kind of auditions before. The sort of, like, I'd gone down to Letterman and different things, and, like, you know, they basically just used to sort of be like, hey, can you put on this turban and sit on this carpet and pretend like you're flying for, like, a comedy bit that we're going to do? You know, so I thought, it's going to be one of these things. And so I said no. And then they called back 5 minutes later and they said, are you sure? They kind of want you to come down, and it's not for what you think it is. It's for a correspondent. And so I said, well, what time do they want me to come down? And they said, by 3. I said, oh, I'll be there at 3. I don't know why I had this attitude, but I kind of had this sort of like, Daily Show is beneath me. I've been on Broadway. You know what I mean?
You were in Oklahoma.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So I was like, I've been in Oklahoma, Mr. Stewart. I don't know if you're aware of my resume. But I did. I went down and I met John, and, you know, I was a fan of the show. I used to watch it back then. Don't anymore. But now, no. But we just did this piece that they had written, and I didn't really know what I was doing. So I just figured I'll just do my best Stephen Colbert impression. So I did, and John turned to me and said, congratulations, welcome to the show. And I really thought he was kidding. I was like, what do you mean? But he said, well, you'll be on the show tonight. And he was like, do you have plans? And what's really bizarre about it is that I go into my first ever rehearsal, and it's usually just a couple of producers and some writers and stuff sitting there, and I'm rehearsing, and I look out, and there's a guy sitting there with a baseball cap on, and he's like watching the rehearsal. And I sort of look closely, and I realize that it's Bruce Springsteen. And I'm like, wow, Bruce Springsteen works at The Daily Show.
But then you get the job, and you were the senior Muslim correspondent,
yes,
the senior brown correspondent. It's not being on a carpet in a turban, but did it irk you at all?
It's a version of that, is what you're saying.
No,
yeah, I know what you're
saying. It's knowing.
No, you know, I think, I mean, we are ultimately, at the end of the day, sort of parodying the real news. So I was happy at that point, because initially I remember saying to John, like, do you want me to do an accent? And he was like, no, not at all. So I think I was in this place where I was like, just happy to like, not have to be like, did it me, you know, like that. And I could just be myself and sort of play, you know, an Indian American. So, yeah, I started out, and you know, still do a lot of the pieces that pertain to brown people. And brown people are in the news a lot, so it's good.
And yeah. And it's senior Muslim correspondent with a very sharp point. Mm. One of my favorites was after the home improvement store Lowe's pulled its ads from a show called All American Muslim, because just associating with anything Muslim was controversial, you reported on why Lowe's should shut down entirely.
Without the store Lowe's, the jihadist goal is unachievable, John. If you were a Muslim who wants to build a bomb, sorry, I'm obviously being redundant, but what would you build it out of?
I don't know how to build bombs. What, wiring? PVC pipe, fertilizer, I guess.
Yep. Or, as they call it here, aisle five. John, Lowe's is to Muslims what F.A.O. Schwartz is to nine-year-olds.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations gave you a Courage in Media award. Yeah. The ACLU gave you a Social Responsibility in Media award. I mean, you use your powers for good.
I make funny faces. The CARE Award was really nice, although it was a little bit absurd, because I remember going out to the ceremony, and the guy that they were giving the award to before me was a Syrian pianist and composer whose parents had been beaten up by the Assad government, and they had death threats against him and all of this stuff, and they're showing a video of his work and his family, and it was a devastating story of real courage and standing up to a despot and all this stuff, and he gets the award, and then next it's me, and it's basically like, I'm like, you know, and they're showing clips of me doing pratfalls and making faces, and then, so it was a tough act to follow, you know?
But how important is Muslimness to your work?
I've spent more times in bars than in mosques, you know? So I'm a terrible sort of role model for anything Muslim. But culturally, I am Muslim. And I also recognize how few sort of faces there are of moderate Muslim American identity in today's media, on television, anywhere. So I recognize the need for that in our culture and in the media. So I don't think about it too much, my Muslimness. The sort of character that I play on The Daily Show, what he means on a cultural level, is beyond what I am. I mean, there was a period of time when I was doing a lot of pieces back to back that were all about like Islamophobia and Muslim stuff. And I remember saying to John, actually, in the hallway one time when I met him, I was like, I just need to do like a normal piece. Like one piece now where it does nothing to do with like being Muslim or anything like that. It started to sort of like get to me a little bit, you know. But for the most part, it's fascinating to me.
Haven't you ever had a moment where you just couldn't believe what the clueless guest was saying?
Yeah, that is one of the perks / depressing things about being a Daily Show correspondent.
That woman in Tennessee?
Yeah.
She's opposing this mosque being built in Tennessee. And then she goes on to say everything she knows about Muslims, culminating with the fact that a third of all Muslims are terrorists.
You do know I'm Muslim, right?
Nobody's perfect.
You know, that moment when she says nobody's perfect is such a classic sort of Daily Show experience, because that wasn't her initial answer. Her initial answer was something much more diplomatic, like, well, I assume that perhaps you were, da-da-da, you know. Then we had to stop and change tape, and her husband, who was sitting off to the side, who sort of fancied himself as a stand-up comic, said, you know, honey, you know what you should say when he asks you that question about being Muslim? You should say, hey, nobody's perfect. Right? Huh? Huh? And she actually was like, oh, can I redo that?
So as a fake journalist doing fake news, do you feel any sense of journalistic responsibility?
None. I mean, other than the fact that we are dealing with real stories and real news items, in that way, we want to tell the story. But, you know, our currency is ultimately comedy, and we sort of look for the hypocrisy. We look for where the laughs are.
Okay, so let's see. I took a little inventory. You were a doctor in The Dictator.
Wow.
You were a doctor on CSI.
Yes.
You were a doctor on Oz.
Yes.
And on The Sopranos.
Yes.
And on the TV series Jericho.
Yes.
And in the Ricky Gervais film Ghost Town. You were a terrorist in Sleeper Cell, and that was very scary.
Welcome to Hollywood, folks. This is what it is to be a brown guy in Hollywood. I used to play cab drivers when I was starting out, and then I sort of...
You were promoted.
To doctor, and then I got promoted to terrorist, you know? I actually even played a doctor on a soap opera where they just couldn't be bothered with a name, so they were like, why don't we just call you Dr. Manvi? And I was like, okay. And so literally in the soap opera, you hear like, paging Dr. Manvi. Paging that, and you know, my mother was very proud.
Was she? But in June, there's a new Owen Wilson, Vince Vaughn vehicle called The Internship that hits screens. They play interns at Google, and your character is running the internship.
Right.
You're a taskmaster.
Mm-hmm.
You have a thick Indian accent.
Well, not so thick, but all right.
Does it bother you at all that they ask for the accent?
Initially, I was like, I'm not doing the accent. And then they were like, here's how much money you'll make. No. I was like, I will do the accent. But honestly, I often feel like with that sort of situation that it's really about the writing and it's really where the comedy comes from. If the comedy is about the accent, then I have a problem with it. But what makes him funny is not his accent.
In 1998, you created a one-man show called Sakina's Restaurant,
yes.
out of which grew the film, which is incredibly sweet, called Today's Special,
yes,
which is
you.
A romantic comedy about a prodigal son. He's a young chef who cooks by the book, but he learns how to trust himself, improvise, embrace life, and even please his dad.
Yeah, yeah. They were all characters sort of based on my family, and we developed this one-person show, and I didn't know where to set it. I thought, well, I'll set it in a restaurant because it's a very easy access point for most Americans. Then when we made the movie, we took the restaurant element and really used food as a metaphor of transformation and culture. And for me, the movie is really about the integration of identity, you know, and the idea that the lead character can never really be himself until he has reconciled his immigrant identity and where he comes from with where he is today, and ultimately becomes whole.
And you got raves for your performance in Disgraced. It ran on Broadway until very recently. It's a story about how to make it in America, and it could have fit into any era, really. In the case of your character, he rejects the Muslim faith he was born into. He gives himself up voluntarily for searches at the airport. Mm-hmm. He's a successful mergers and acquisitions lawyer. Mm-hmm. What drew you to that? Is it that theme of integration, which the character in your film handles more successfully than the character in Disgrace?
Well, the character in today's special is dealing with some of the very same issues, but we just come at it from a comedic tone. And in Disgrace, Ayad Akhtar, who wrote the play, a brilliant writer, who sent me the script about 2 years ago, and it was one of the bravest plays I'd ever read. And when we did it at Lincoln Center, you know, it was really interesting. The beauty of plays is that you start to understand, especially a new play, you start to understand what the play is over the course of time as different audiences come and see it. And, you know, it really is about a Muslim American man who is struggling with his identity, and it ends in a very sad, devastating place. But how many people actually sort of identified with that character, you know, and identified with his struggle that when push comes to shove, however much we want to talk about the United Colors of Benetton, we end up gravitating towards these very base tribal identities that we have. And whether you had Muslims or Jews or African-Americans or whoever, like, come see this play, they recognize something about themselves.
Tell me about how, for many years, Omar Sharif haunted your life.
You know, it's funny because we finish where we start, which is basically that these American iconic characters that I used to watch, you know, like the Fonz and stuff like that. And then one day I saw this actor, Omar Sharif, in Dr. Zhivago. And at that time, he was the only sort of non-Caucasian heroic figure that you could find in Hollywood movies, you know? He and Sidney Poitier, that was it. I met him as a waiter at a restaurant. I said, you know, Dr. Zhivago changed my life. And he turned to me and he said, oh, really? Mine too.
Is it true, you know, you've raised John Stewart, that absolute power corrupts absolutely?
Are you saying that's that about John Stewart? I can't answer that. He's awesome. He's a benevolent dictator.
Thank you again.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
What Thank a you very much. Yeah.
Of course, this was just part of a much longer conversation with Asif. To watch the whole video, go to our website, onthemedia.org. By the way, you're listening to music from his film, Today's Special.
That's it for this week's show. On the Medium was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, our intern who, we're sorry to say, is leaving this week. She was fantastic and was a big part in the piece on the White House. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Frankel.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. And our boss, bassist-composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.